Okay, let's get launched into hour number two with Clifford Carnicom. We're talking about chemtrails, and to kick off this hour, let me read, for those of you not online, the letter from the United States Air Force Lieutenant Colonel retired of heavy chemtrails over Pittsburgh, and this is a very important story. This is a little longer, but bear with me, it's worth hearing. This is a professional military officer of nearly three decades of service to you and to me. Dear Jeff, Friday, October 13th, 2007, 10 p.m. I live 20 miles southwest of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and at the present time we have a chemtrail sky that is the worst I've seen. We had a beautiful clear sky day here until late afternoon. It was so clear, in fact, that another fellow and I in the office were discussing how nice it would be to stargaze tonight, even though there will be a full moon. We are both amateur astronomers. However, by the time I got home at 5:05 p.m., I noticed sun dogs and the oily rainbows around the sun. There were a few chemtrail lines, but not all that many. Nevertheless, I immediately recognized it as a chemtrail sky. When I came out to wash off the car after dinner at 6:20 p.m., I couldn't believe it. The whole sky was X'd over in a grid pattern. I ran in and got the camera, a Canon AE-1E with a 200-millimeter telephoto lens, and took a dozen photos, which I'll email you. And several of those photos from the Lieutenant Colonel are up there right now. He goes on to say, I'm going to edit through this quickly. This spraying was of the high-altitude type, not low-altitude, and the only aircraft I saw in the area were multi-engine jet aircraft. This was so strong of a spraying effort that I questioned whether to allow my own daughter to go to her homecoming game that night because I don't want her sitting in the bleachers with this stuff drifting down on her. I watched it carefully for some time but did not detect any droplets or web-like material, probably because of the high altitude of the spray. On a personal note, I want to assure you that I do not take this matter lightly. I am a retired lieutenant colonel from the United States Air Force and the Pennsylvania Air National Guard. At the time I retired, after 29 years of service, I was a squadron commander with a KC-135E unit, and I certainly can recognize a normal tanker contrail when I see one or identify the shadow outline of one of our aircraft in the sky. One of the things I want understood is that the spraying from a tanker is not unheard of, regardless of what anyone else tells you. It's what is being sprayed that is the puzzle now. I have a photograph here in my collection that I personally took in 1969 when flying in a KC-135A on a trip from Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, North Carolina, to Pease Air Force Base, New Hampshire. After we took off and reached altitude, most likely over Virginia, we lowered the refueling boom in the bottom rear of the aircraft and dumped 3,000 pounds of JP-4 into the atmosphere just to trim out the aircraft and improve its weight and balance. Nothing was considered unusual with this procedure. The reason I bring it up here is to show that there are reasons for a tanker to sometimes spray fuel into the atmosphere. However, what we are seeing today is not the occasional spraying I am talking about. When we dumped fuel, we didn't fly in a grid pattern, for example. I hope this helps anyone who thought they may be seeing something unusual in the skies on Friday over southwestern Pennsylvania. Sincerely, Lieutenant Colonel Dan Ardinger, U.S. Air Force, retired. Okay, Clifford.
This officer deserves credit for speaking with integrity on this subject.
You bet.
And it used to be that, just as a couple of follow-through comments on the last discussion, it used to be that with rank in this country was associated an implied trust, implied respect, and implied honesty. And with letters to the contrary by Lieutenant Colonel Gibson, a different officer, declaring something which is simply not true, in the end, it's actually a disservice to the institutions to which is served. And it's a disservice to the American people to belie those institutions which are intended to defend and to protect. And I'd like to mention and give some more credit where it's due to a couple other folks that have worked us in, worked on this in the background.
Sure.
And I'd like people to take notice and take the time and pay attention to an author by the name of Diane Harvey, who has written several very pointed letters and commentary on the subject.
The exceptional writer, yes.
And there is a recent one that's entitled Petition for Disclosure. The American public should read that petition for disclosure. Take note that the words are carefully chosen and well-phrased. And they should act upon that petition that she has submitted for their benefit and on their behalf. And she simply deserves credit as a person who speaks clearly and has a gift with words, which is also needed to communicate with people. In addition to that, in a general nature, there's a lot of folks on this that are devoting their time and effort and working that, this is not a glory venture, and there's a lot of people putting in countless hours and hours and days. I'd like to mention Dave Peterson up in Colorado, who I work very closely with, a person who gets things done over and over and over. No gratitude expected or especially received. You have Kim Weber running the chemtrail tracking message board, who has spent countless days and hours organizing material, the logistics of things. Lori Kramer that she works with, Will Thomas for his journalism work, and Tony Thayer for her efforts in starting a nonprofit organization to try to get the American public involved. In addition to that, there are countless researchers, some of true merit, on the message forum that I maintain, that simply choose to avoid any notoriety, any public view whatsoever, but in the end contribute some of the most significant research to this issue. So people need to know that a lot of people across the country have put a great deal of effort and time, and it is this government which should be putting that time and effort into addressing this problem.
And not one of our phony congressmen or women will take this issue on that I've heard of.
You know, another whole subject, if we want it sometime, is simply to take, again, objectively, take the responses which have been received. I have about a dozen of them now. And to simply go through these responses, and I doubt that we'll do it tonight, but if individuals will take the time to do that, there is no conclusion that can be reached other than there is a deliberate avoidance and denial of the issue. It's across the board. And there's not anyone that's really innocent in this matter. You know, if you want to bring up one issue, ask the environmental organizations. We have a legacy of environmental organizations across this country that supposedly have taken tremendous steps to protect the environment. The American public needs to ask where those organizations are now.
Sure.
And where they've been for the last 2 years.
Well, most of them are being bankrolled by the very corporations that are doing the damage, which is the irony of it all.
You know, take a look at the statements by Greenpeace. Greenpeace saying, we have no real knowledge of this affair, so we cannot make a comment on it. Greenpeace saying we're unable to help.
Apparently they've never visited your website. This is an absolutely stupefying statement from them.
You know, so there's not an innocence here, and there's no glory attached to the environmental organizations of this country. They are, again, some of the most negligent participants, or non-participants.
That's right.
In this issue. And they need to be put in the perspective that they deserve, and that is one of non-assistance, non-activism, which they claim fame for.
Amen to that. Well said.
And those topics being discussed, I think that it might be a good time to try to go into this sort of more comprehensive subject.
Okay, we're just about a minute to the break, so let's just pause a little bit more, and then we'll jump right into it after that. I want to again point out the comparison between a Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Air Force, retired, who observes 29 years in service with KC-135s, and a Lieutenant Colonel paper pusher, apparently, who has issued a condoned, sanctioned, approved lie to the American public, which obviously came down from the uppermost levels of the United States Air Force. You folks had better figure it out now, and you had better get on the phone, and you had better demand that your phony congressmen or women, those talk cheap specialists who only worry about being reelected, do something about this. And yes, there are a few good ones out there. I don't mean to discount all of them, but I'm real tired of opportunism, of ego, of fraud, allegedly representing our interests in Washington.
Stay tuned for more Phenomenal Talk with Jeff Rentz.
Okay, we're back. Clifford, go right ahead. Let's get right into it now. We've got about 6 minutes in this segment, so go ahead.
Thank you, Jeff.
Sure.
What I'd like to talk about now, and I guess what I'll do is simply say where I'm headed, and then we'll follow the sequence of events which leads up to that proposition.
All right.
Where we're headed is that there now exists a solid scientific basis for the testing of trace metal compounds in our environment, meaning the air, the water, and the soil. We're at a point where a sufficient basis, again, for formal investigation exists for the detection of trace metal compounds in our environment. And what I'd like to do to basically demonstrate the seriousness of those people that are involved in this issue is outline those sequences of events which have led to this proposition. And it becomes a little bit more technical, I guess, but one of my jobs here is to try to communicate effectively, and I will try to do that. And the goal is not to lose anyone. I give your audience credit to being very capable of understanding if it's communicated properly. And how this starts goes back to those studies that I mentioned earlier involving relative humidity. Those studies established a beginning for this set of reasoning. And it starts like this. If you accept that the relative humidity conditions are not sufficient for generating cloud formation at levels of 30% when they're known and established to only occur at 70% or higher, then you have to ask, well, why does that happen? Why is it happening? How is it happening? What would make that happen? How could you have clouds forming when they don't normally form? And are they indeed clouds? Are they water? And the first conclusion that has to be reached is that the most logical way in which you can now alter that process where you start having cloud formations at such low relative humidities is with the introduction of a salt. And, you know, it's funny how it takes 2 years sometimes to get back to the levels of common sense.
Uh-huh.
But in a way, that's what actually happens here. Think about what it is. What absorbs water? What is most loving of water? And a salt form is a very logical choice. And if you look at those cases meteorologically where they claim and state that clouds do begin forming at lower levels of relative humidity, namely 70%, not 30, they will always introduce the notion of the existence of a salt in those cases. Example being along the coastline where you get a haze or so. The reason that you get those formations occurring at lower relative humidity is because of the existence of a salt. So now you have to project that further and say, well, how do you get down to 30%? What would you do? And the logical case can be made is that if you deliberately introduce a salt form you could conceivably alter that process. Remember also that it was established in the earlier conversation that we had that the size of the particles is also very significant. And if you combine the prospect of introducing a salt material of extreme microscopic size, you at least can entertain the possibility and reasonable explanation for the formation of clouds at levels of relative humidity lower than is expected.
Okay.
Significant difference.
Okay. Levels down again, instead of 70%, down to 30% perhaps.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So this is, I guess, point number one, is that there is a good case for saying, you know, it's quite reasonable that there is something physical being introduced up there, and a salt fits. And it's sort of an interesting sequence of events that has taken place here, because sometimes, you know, the loop is not all linear, and you do thinking, and it comes back around to places you've been before, but you need to advance to go backwards sometimes. And I will just introduce pieces of information, and in the end, the goal is to have it somewhat as a composite coordinated whole. The next piece of information that is given to us is that you have an anonymous source, you know, the classic anonymous source.
Yep.
But this anonymous source is stated to be extremely reliable. I certainly have a great deal of respect and trust in the individual that communicated the information to me originally.
Right.
And the reliable source simply makes the statement that what is involved, let's just say a major component. Remember, we have three forms that we're talking about thus far that have been identified. But a major component is the use of barium salt, and it was stated to be used in connection with advanced radar studies. Basically, a single statement of information, no name, simply stated to be reliable.
Mm-hmm.
I sat with that information for months. I was unable to use that information in any way because I could not coordinate it with the fibrous material I was looking at.
Right.
I had not developed my work far enough in the meteorological side yet to make a tie-in. But when that information was given to me and I started my work in meteorology, there started to appear to be at least, let's say, the notion should be entertained as whether or not these two events might be related. My research was completely independent. I had no source telling me what it was. I simply did observations and made conclusions.
Got it.
Classic analytic work.
All right, let me ask you to hold. We have to take that break now. 7 minutes has run by already. Come right back and pick it up right there with the conclusions with Clifford Carnicom. I hope you're paying close attention and visit that website, carnicom.com. It's all there. And if you can get hold of one of your alleged congressional representatives, force them to sit down and look at this site as much as you can. Call their office, fax them, email them. Tell them you want some hard answers as to why they will not pursue this. See what you get. Be right back.
Stay tuned for more Phenomenal Talk with Jeff Ritz.
From coast to coast, an update on the chemtrail outrage that continues to be perpetrated above our heads, coast to coast, over many urban areas. Look at the satellite pictures, folks, that are up at the top of my headlines. Look at the pictures on Clifford's website at carnicom.com, and listen to the man himself. Go ahead, Cliff.
Thank you, Jeff. And keep in mind that the other forms of physical material are not to be discounted. They are to be given equal weight in the overall evaluation as to the extent and scope of the program. But for right now, the focus is on a hypothesis that has developed concerning the existence, unusual existence, of trace metal salts in the atmosphere. And The proposition is now at the point where you have two sources of information, both which are independently led to the prospect of a salt form being introduced, one source specifically stating barium salts without substantiation or justification at that point. And what I did at that point was simply run with that idea. Let's just consider the possibility. What if it were, if the specific salt form were a barium compound? Would that make sense? And does it fit the observations? Is it consistent with all of the data, which is very important and very difficult to come up with something that fits all of the data? And so what I did is dig into, I have to educate myself as I go along. I don't claim to be an expert in all fields by any means. My background is in primarily in mathematics and geophysical sciences. But if we need to learn, we learn. And what I've done is dig into the chemistry of barium and just ask, what if? What happens? And it becomes rather interesting. And Jeff, can you tell me roughly how much time you have left for this? Because I'll try to pace it.
About 5 minutes until the break, and then about 9 minutes after that.
Okay, thank you, and I'll try to pace this to that end.
All right, if you'd like to carry on into the third hour, you're welcome. Just pace yourself and see how it goes.
Okay. Take a look at barium, and there are many forms of barium. There's two main forms that are mined naturally. One is called barium carbonate, witherite, and the other is barium sulfate. And I simply looked into these. What do these compounds do? What happens to them? And barium carbonate has become of greater interest to me in that investigation. Barium sulfate is non-soluble. It's used in the medical field. But we're dealing with supposedly water vapor in a cloud, certainly a part of the atmosphere composed of water vapor, and we're looking for something that's consistent with the physics and chemistry of that. So my attention was devoted more directly towards barium carbonate because it's rather interesting. What happens if you take barium carbonate, a naturally occurring mineral, and you burn it? If you burn it, you get barium oxide. Barium oxide and carbon dioxide. Barium oxide is a whitish powder. It's consistent at that point. Now, what's interesting is this question of combustion, because one of the things that has never been resolved in this issue, there's been a lot of banter back and forth, is, oh, are they spraying, or oh, are they burning it? They're just burning it in the engines. And I have to say that it's been a very difficult thing to decide. I, with the best telephotos that I have never been able to eliminate the engines or combustion process from this phenomenon. Although there are cases that very clearly indicate a discrete point of emission, there are also equal cases where that that point of origination is not clear and does appear as though it could satisfy a process of combustion. So if you were to burn barium carbonate, you'd get barium oxide. Barium oxide has some interesting properties. Number one is that it absorbs water very readily. It loves water. It reacts very aggressively with water.
Mm-hmm.
It is whitish powder in form. And number three, it induces respiratory distress, especially bronchitis. And it is used as a desiccant, a drying agent, in certain arenas. These qualities certainly captured my attention. And to follow that chemistry through a little bit further, what happens now if you have barium oxide in the atmosphere? And because it combines so aggressively with water, it forms a hydroxide form, barium hydroxide. Any hydroxide is a base, what would be called a base in the chemical world,
right?
As opposed to an acid. And that's what it forms. And then the next step in the chemical development is that it forms something called barium hydrate, which is basically barium hydroxide combining with water. The point is that a process of combustion can result in a whitish powder which satisfies the observations which do occur and satisfies the chemistry of combining with water. It still, by the way, still exists as a powder or crystal throughout this entire process.
All right.
Which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That last form, barium hydrate, remains that way as a powder or a crystal, always white. And so you end up at this point with what would be called a hydrated salt form, a salt form that is attached to water and also is extremely soluble in water. If you look at the different forms, there's the reason this is getting interesting, too, is because there's only about seven compounds that fit the criteria. There aren't that many hydroxides. You're talking about group one and two elements in group two on the periodic table. And by the way, I will mention that one of those elements, strontium chloride, is a salt, and it is known, it is established to absorb water at relative humidities of 27%. So it is physically possible for a salt to do what is being observed. So you now end up with a base form of a particular barium compound. Here is what happened. If that were true, if such a thing were to happen, then it's logical to consider the question of testing the pH level of rainwater.
Sure.
It's a very interesting question, because if one says, well, there's a hydroxide being formed, a base, then gee whiz, wouldn't it be in the water? Wouldn't it be in the rainwater? And so that idea was proposed by myself and tested by myself. And I was rather surprised at the results, because I collected rainwater in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is a very rare commodity, by the way, five times in the last year total. And I tested the pH of that rainwater, and I came up a value of 6.6. Let us say that it was slightly acidic, very slightly. You could almost call it neutral. And I was surprised, because it was exactly the opposite of what I expected. If something is a base, it will lean to the other side of the scale, and you would get numbers like 7 or 8. 7 is a neutral point, 0 is acid, or 1, and 14 is a base. I end up with a number slightly acidic. That threw me at that time, because I expected it to be on the alkaline scale if indeed a hydroxide was formed. At that point, I asked the question in a more open way and said, what is the pH of rainwater supposed to be? I was acting on the assumption that it's perfectly neutral, should be a pH 0.7, not acidic or basic. And in the end, that's a rather faulty assumption. If you look at the pH of rainwater, it is naturally acidic. The number that is a natural point of equilibrium for rainwater is 5.6. Now, I'll try not to be consumed in numbers here, but it's important, because the natural equilibrium point of rainwater is at a more acidic level than what I was finding in my test.
Huh.
Now, what this means, what this indicates, is that, in fact, the rainwater that I was testing was more alkaline than that which is expected. So the word relative is very important here. The rainwater tested was more alkaline than that which was anticipated.
Huh.
That finding is actually then in accordance with the original hypothesis.
Yep.
That there is a hydroxide compound.
Yes.
Within that rainwater.
Yes, yes, yes.
And I hope that the audience has followed this point, because it is a very important one, even though it's slightly technical. The point is that in a relative sense, the findings were exactly in accordance with the original hypothesis, even though it was never anticipated at the beginning.
All right, let's pause right there. More than a theory, it is utterly pragmatic and logical. Clifford has put together a very important potential piece of this puzzle. Be right back. Get back to Clifford Carnicum. I'm Jeff Rentz, Coast to Coast, and about 11 minutes, Cliff, so let's go ahead and get through. That was really a very logical and simple explanation of point A going to point B, and go ahead.
Thank you, Jeff. What I'll do is make this next segment very short, and then I'll come back to the pH issue, which is extremely important. At this point in staging the investigation, I'm still acting as an individual researcher. I don't really have access to other information. But I did I had received some physical powder material that had been collected on the surface of a car immediately after, let's not say immediately because that wouldn't be correct, but after the aerial activity was observed. And there were, let's just say, if you were to hold to that hypothesis of there being a barium hydrate form, there's a couple of chemical tests which can be conducted, which would, let's say, satisfy its existence or its non-existence. It doesn't positively prove the existence of the compound, but there's further refinement in your state of knowledge about this compound. Let's just summarize that by saying I conducted those chemical tests, and the results of those tests were completely consistent with the existence of a barium hydrate form. Now I would like to go back to the pH issue, which it needs to be thoroughly and completely and adequately explained, and the importance of it relayed to the American people. And it's not to be done just at this time, but it needs to be reiterated again and again and again.
Mm-hmm.
Because my results were interesting enough to me, and I had run a statistical test, and they showed themselves to be significant, even with my limited sample. At this point, I said, okay, let's try to get more data. So I opened up the invitation for people across the country to start testing rainwater across the country through the website and through the message board. And to date, there are now 37 samples of rainwater in roughly 15 states across the country have been collected.
Mm-hmm.
And appreciation is extended to all of these people that have assisted. And by the way, 37 in the statistical world is actually considered a large sample. Once you start getting over 30 values, you have a significant sample statistically. It would be in what would be called large sampling theory. So we needn't be deceived into thinking that you always have thousands and thousands of measurements on the Gallup poll. That's not realistic in the real world. And the results of this test are showing as follows. There is a difference in the pH that's showing up. The value is 1.2. Now, that by itself doesn't mean much, but let me try and translate it. And what it means in the physical world, in the real world, is that there is roughly a 20-fold increase, a 20-fold change in the chemical composition of the atmosphere as related to hydroxide ions.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd like to read a single sentence if I can. And the source of this statement is to be given due consideration. This statement comes from the Nobel Prize winner for chemistry. I think it was 1995, maybe 1997. And the man's name is Crutzen, I'm sorry. And he's also tied in with the Max Planck Institute.
Okay.
But here's a statement. It comes from an atmospheric chemistry book published by Scientific American. Here's a statement. The single most important chemical species in clouds and precipitation is the hydrogen ion,
mm-hmm.
whose concentration can be indicated by specifying the solution's acidity or pH value. This is an important statement, a very important statement. You basically have the Nobel Prize winner for chemistry, director of one of the leading atmospheric research institutes in the country.
Right, in the world, yeah.
That if there was one thing, that you could focus on
mm-hmm.
that would indicate the chemical nature
mm-hmm.
of the clouds in our sky, what would it be? It would be the acid and base level. It would be the pH. And the results of the testing that has now come across by individuals across the country
mm-hmm.
is showing that within the last year, and this is the most amazing thing, within the last 12 months, there has been a change on the magnitude of 20 times that which has been historically recorded. And when you talk about historically there, you're not even talking about scores of years. You're talking about thousands to hundreds of thousands of years in terms of the chemical nature. In the last 12 months, we have seen a remarkable transformation in the chemical nature of the atmosphere. If you run the statistical test on these things, they are off the chart. 99.9999%.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It is clear as can be that a change has occurred. And if you look at the data, what it's being compared to, I have compared it to both 1990 and 1999 data. Two different sets, spaced 9 years apart, compared against the year 2000. The data is exactly the same in terms of its difference. It's exactly the same in terms of its difference from 1990 and exactly the same in terms of its difference from 1999. The logical conclusion is that the primary change has occurred in the last 12 months. What has been significant in the last 12 months to 2 years? The coordinated, systematic, deliberate introduction of aerosols clearly visible across the skies of the country. And if you want a topic to further investigate and to further clamor about, it is this most pointed indicator of transformation of the chemistry of the atmosphere. And what does it all mean? What it means is that there is something there. There's something physically there that is not water. So it behooves us to find out what it is. At this stage, the pH data already tells you that it is likely a hydroxide salt form. That's a significant piece of information.
Sure is.
Okay? And that conclusion is completely consistent with all of the data and observations that precede it.
You may have put it together, at least a major piece of it. We got about 2 minutes.
Now you get to the point where you need to go after the particular salt. What is it? Which one is it? If you know it's a hydroxide salt, which one is it?
Mm-hmm.
And as I said before, the number of candidates is actually relatively few. There is a strong indication that a major component of this program will be solved. I'm fairly confident of that. It's a matter of time. The next stage of testing that I did was to get involved with electrolysis, because once again, you always try to prove things from multiple vantage points.
Mm-hmm.
And I have recently got involved with electrolysis. Electrolysis is the business of putting current through a solution. You stick electrodes into a solution. And the general story is that if it's pure water, it doesn't do much. It doesn't do much at all. But if it has salt in it, it has a reaction. These are electrolytes. This is what your car battery is about. Electrolytes in a solution conduct electricity.
Yes.
If your hypothesis was that there is an alkaline salt in the rainwater,
and
once again, it's logical that you should be able to test that water and have a reaction.
Mm-hmm.
I have done that. And again, the results are consistent with the existence of an alkaline salt within that water. The concentration levels of this, as indicated, you can actually work backwards from the pH values. Concentration values are actually, at least in a single rainfall, potentially very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why sophisticated testing is going to be needed for quantitative work.
All right. We will hope to see that. Your next report, Clifford, we'll trust that someone will come forward to help move this process forward. You're working your hardest, as are many other people, and I thank you from all of us for all that you do.
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. I appreciate it very much.
I look forward to our next talk, Cliff. Thanks. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Clifford Carnicom, his website is www.carnicom, C-A-R-N-I-C-O-M, carnicom.com. Okay, time for a break. When we come back, we're going to visit again with Joe Hall and talk about the latest in electromagnetic field protection. New data in, and boy, is it exciting. So stay with us, and we shall continue.